Good evening, everyone. Welcome back to our weekly session. I've been thinking about one of the great archetypes in Buddhist tradition, Avalokiteshvara, who is also the Bodhisattva. Sometimes we say the Bodhisattva of compassion. And in Chinese and Japanese, we call her, so it's often represented as a woman, Kanzeon or Canon. In the Tibetan, it's Chinrezig, I think, or something like that. And this is really one of the primary figures in our Buddhist tradition. It's seen as a model, a role model, something to aspire to. It's often said that the Dalai Lama is a present day incarnation of Avalokiteshvara. The way that he comports himself in the world, his practice, his selfless giving, his devotion to bringing the teachings of wisdom and compassion to anyone, everywhere. With no attachments, no strings attached, in other words. So when we think of Avalokiteshvara, we can think, okay, the Dalai Lama, just to have an idea of someone, a living being who represents that. Of course, there are many other examples. And in fact, each one of us, at some moments in our life, probably embody that. We may not be aware of it, but we all are that already intrinsically. We all are the Avalokiteshvara. That's not the same thing. Acknowledging that is not the same thing as experiencing it, of course. We have the intrinsic and the experiential always. So, but already, if we can say intrinsically, we each are that. I am that, but also the other is that as well. Sometimes it's harder to say it about oneself, and sometimes it's really, really hard to say it about the other. One of the hallmarks of Avalokiteshvara is we also say it's the one who hears the sounds of the world. Sometimes we say hears the cries of the world. The point being that Avalokiteshvara listens. Listens, it could be just a big ear. Listens intently. Listens deeply. Listens without prejudice, without attachment to thought patterns and beliefs and opinions. Just listens. Listens. Hears the sounds of the world. And in order to do that, Avalokiteshvara doesn't get in her own way. So when I say get it, so we sometimes say, okay, well, I'll listen, but then I get in the way. I get distracted. I'm not giving my full attention to the sounds. I get distracted by, I like that sound and I don't like that one. I get distracted by something in me that is, actively trying to be heard and is overwhelming the other sounds, whatever that might be. I get distracted by my opinions, anger, fear, anxiety, sadness, If we really listen to the sounds of the world, we can be overcome with sorrow, or we can be overcome with anger, or we can be overcome with despair. So when Avalokiteshvara listens, she listens openly, attentively, and without getting in the way. Disengaging from her thought patterns and beliefs and opinions. Another way of saying this is that, or another way of approaching it, maybe let's say that. Another way of approaching it is that can we listen as if every sound is the teaching of the Buddha, or every sound is the Dharma? It is. Every sound is the Dharma. It is a teaching. We don't know what that teaching is. But we don't listen so that we can know what the teaching is. We listen, to hear the sounds, to open to the sounds, whatever they are, to the 10,000 sounds. We talk about the 10,000 things, which is all phenomena. Same thing applies to this 10,000 sounds, all sounds. And they are all teachings, they are all the Dharma. And if we can keep that in mind, that helps us to not be caught by our judgments about that's a good sound and that's a bad sound. Of course, some sounds hurt our ears, The one we always give is, like a fingernail scratching on a chalkboard or some really unpleasant sound, But that doesn't mean that that is not the Dharma. We may not like it, but it's the Dharma. It's a teaching. There's teaching there. And we have koans around sounds, stopping the distant temple bell, hearing the sounds of the world, the cries of the world. People, Mumun, who went on and made this whole collection of koans, was awakened when the sound of a pebble hitting a bamboo. He was raking in the garden and boom, a pebble hit the bamboo. Sounds can be illuminating. They can be disturbing. They can be overwhelming, as I said. But can we receive them all as teachings? Particularly at a moment in our collective life, when there's a lot of sounds we don't want to hear. A lot of, and when I say sounds, it can be talk, it can be events, it can be actions, it can be, a noise in the street, it can be noise in your apartment, it can be a child crying, it can be a cat meowing, it's endless. There's 10,000 sounds, right? And at the moment in our, the turmoil of our world, or the chaos, which is has it's not more or less chaos than it's ever been. Samsara is all times are troubled. That's what samsara is. There's always trouble. So it seems more troubled, or it seems worse, or it seems more horrific. It's different. That's what we can say. It's different. The sounds are different. But we can bring our same intention to listen, to a political discourse or, an argument in the metro, or the birds chirping, or the car passing, you know. We can bring our same intention to all of that, our intention to just listen and receive whatever it is as a teaching. It's messy, right? But, or and it's also, as always, fertile ground for awakening. There is no other ground of awakening than here. So either you do it now or you don't do it. No, but there's nowhere else. This is where you are. This is where we are. This is our moment. And then it's gone. And then there's another moment, and another moment, and another moment. So, what do we do then? You know, so how do we do this? How do we open to these sounds? How do we listen? Well, we sit. You know, we're already doing what we need to do. We have this sitting practice, which is really ideal for it. I've been reading this book that someone gave me by David Lynch, the filmmaker, which is a kind of a collection, I think, of his. I don't know if these are things he wrote elsewhere, or I don't know what it how it came about, but it's about what is it? Meditation, consciousness, and creativity, I think, is the type. It's called, wait, I don't have it here. Oh, here it is. Yeah, here it is. It's called Catching the Big Fish. Meditation, consciousness, and creativity. So this is right in my heart, these subjects, right? So and someone gave this to me for that reason. And David Lynch was, you know, when he died, he'd been practicing meditation twice a day, every single day for 50 years, morning and night. He said from the first time he did meditation, and he remembers the day, July 1st, 1973, he never missed a day. Morning and night, he meditated. That's quite a devoted practitioner, right? And so his, you know, if you have a chance, if you can find it, there's a YouTube video, a 15-minute video of him explaining transcendental meditation, which is the meditation that he did to a, it's in France for some reason, so like a French journalist or something. He says it in English, but, and he has these drawings, and it's really just this beautiful thing where he explains what meditation is with just great passion and clarity, just amazing clarity. So in this book that, you know, what really speaks to me is he talks about beyond the mind, the worlds of the mind and the matter, right? The beyond the right and wrong and good and bad, what we always talk about, what we would say, you know, the absolute or something. In his version of transcendental meditation, you transcend those two fields and you reach the what they call the unified field, which is what we would call the absolute, something like that. And he, you know, he's really big on the fact that physicists have discovered the same thing, that there is a what they call the unified field, where the phrase that David Lynch uses it is everything that is a thing emerges from that unified field. And physicists, scientists have come to this same conclusion. Although, you know, our tradition has been talking about it for 2,500 years. And beyond that, others were talking about it. So it took science a while to catch up. But so he talks about diving into the self, diving into the unified field or consciousness, he calls it, because he said all solutions are found in the unified field. Or they originate in the unified field, in the absolute. So he said, you dive into this ocean of the unified field, not to find specific solutions, but to enliven the unified field, to develop the unified field, so to become more and more familiar with the absolute. So as we sit and we open to what we call emptiness or impermanence or the absolute, we have a glimpse of it, you know, and the more we sit, the more we become familiar with that. And it's true. That's where, as Bernie Glassman's three tenets are, you know, first, not knowing, you let go of your ideas. In order to dive into this field, you have to let go of your ideas. And then you just listen. So I'm coming back to Avalokiteshvara. So you just listen to what is. You just bear witness to it without your ideas and your positions and beliefs. You just listen to it. And then naturally, what David Lynch would call the solution or the big fish emerges. And we know what's appropriate. Whether it's action, whether it's emotion, whether it's speech, thought, whatever, we know. There's this knowing that is not the knowing of that we had before we engaged with not knowing. Okay. And I liked this image of diving into it, not to find a specific solution, not to find anything in particular, but to awaken, to enliven. He calls it enliven. What's another word we could say? But to enhance, to develop, to unfold more this experience of the absolute oneness, emptiness, whatever you want to call it, no self, or true self. In our study group, we had Thomas Merton talking about what was it, the point vierge, which is, you know, comes back to, and then in Joa's talk, there was this question of true self, and we have all these terms for it, all these different explanations and intellectual words for it and things, but it can only that doesn't replace the experience of it. So in this, you know, I think Joa described it as like someplace comfortable or familiar or something like that. In this, you know, in this place, it's not even a place because it's here. But when we plunge into this, into ourself, when we, you know, follow Dogen's path as well, to study the way is to study the self. That means to plunge into the self. Plunge in, and this is all we know, okay? But when we try to find who that self is, we don't know. We don't know. It's not that. 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 And we go deeper and deeper and deeper. And it's ungraspable. And as soon as we're able to say it's ungraspable, well, then something changes. You know, we've. The sound is no longer something we like or dislike. It's just the sound. Because when we're, you know, putting likes and dislikes on sounds or positions or beliefs or ideas, then we're attaching, you know, we're hanging on. We're not really plunging into not knowing. So what does that mean for us in this, you know, world of so much, you know, that feels completely overwhelmed by the three poisons that we call greed, anger, and ignorance? That's the Buddhist terminology for everything that we encounter every day in our lives, right? Greed, anger, and ignorance, whether it's within ourselves or not ourselves, what we think of as not ourselves. So what do we do? You know, I heard a Tibetan, someone from Shogyen Trungpa's tradition, who said, you know, it's well, one thing we can do is we can look at, okay, what is our immediate reaction when we hear bad news, what we think is bad news? And that's a vast category, right? Bad news. We sometimes think it's a bigger category than good news, but it's not. It's just that we're focused on the bad news, you know. So what's our immediate reaction? And this teacher said, if you pay attention, you might find that your first reaction is empathy for those people who are suffering, for the person who's causing the suffering, for the damage that's being done, whatever. But then very quickly, that is taken over by anger, spite, blaming, powerlessness. We can be stunned, shock. There's a plane crash, and your first thing you hear is, you're shocked and you don't know. I'm just saying this because there was a plane crash last week, but you don't know. You're just shocked. Wow, this plane crash in Washington, D.C. Wow. And a helicopter hit an airplane. And it's like, what? It's beyond, we can't even imagine it, you know? But then quickly we do start imagining it. Even though we might, our initial reaction might have been empathy for the people who were in those airplane, in that airplane, or the pilot, or the people, the families, or the people who are responsible for them. I really have great empathy for the people who, the rescue people, and then the people who have to come and go through the wreckage. That must be really a horrible thing to have to experience, you know, go through the wreckage of a plane. And then to identify bodies, you know, you just it, great empathy. But of course, we're really caught up in, and as we see, then the reaction of the powers that be is not empathy. The empathy is quickly lost, and it's all kinds of blaming and all kinds of other stuff, right? And then when we hear that, can we have empathy for those who are bringing all this other stuff into it? Because we know that too is just coming from a place of helplessness, deep helplessness, despair. All kinds of positions, you know. So then we can see that when our own empathy is buried, it too is being buried by all of this stuff, you know, our ego, you know, we want to be important, or we want to be seen, or we want to be seen in a certain way, or we want to be the genius who solves it all. And then we become powerless because we can't solve it all. There's nothing we can do. I am powerless to do anything about the plane crash in Washington. I am powerless to do anything about those people who have lost their families, members, and all of the, you know, horror stories we hear about it. I'm powerless to do anything about the reaction of the authorities. I'm powerless to do anything about the wildflowers in California. I'm powerless to do anything about the people who were murdered in a school in Sweden. You know, all of this bad news that's overwhelming, and my empathy gets lost by my, gets buried under my powerlessness. And then I become reactionary and I become angry and I, you know, like to talk about it all the time and then look at the news all the time. I recently had a, last week I had a meeting with some of my colleagues. We teach the Healthy Boundaries course, and all of them, there were only two, three of us who weren't in America. And, you know, of course, everyone was very concerned about the state of affairs in America. And many of them said that they have taken an oath almost to only look at the news once a day. That it's not an oath to not look, because that's not, that is not keeping with our practice to hear the sounds of the world, but it's not indulging in it either, right? It's like, okay, pay attention, listen to the sounds of the world, but you don't have to do it every 5 minutes, right? And that helps them to then maintain, to remember, to come back to just this, to come back to empathy, to come back to humility, to come back to wisdom and compassion, to come back to just sitting, and to come back to what they can do. So, what can we do? Like Bernie Glassman used to say, you know, it's better to do one small thing that you can do than to fantasize about all the stuff you can't do. And that makes perfect sense, right? We hear that and we say, well, of course, that makes sense, you know. We lose so much time and energy and don't do anything when we're fantasizing about everything we can't do. So what is the one thing I can do? One thing we can do at every moment, you know, we can't change the universe, but we can change how we experience it. And that's what our sitting practice is we're saying, okay, you know, okay, I'm really despondent about this. I'm really disappointed with the way the world is going. Well, that disappointment or despair or something, that's a real motivation to change. Okay, so then what shall I do? You know, so then we sit. So you've turned to this path. There are, you know, many other paths you could have turned to, but you have turned to this path, which is a path, a radical subversive path of awakening. Of opening the heart. It's a revolution of the heart and the mind, you know. On the French radio FIP that I listened to, they were, for some reason, they were playing like revolution songs. So there was the Beatles Revolution. And then after that, there was, I think it's Gil Scott-Heron or someone who the revolution will not be televised. I don't know if anyone knows that. It's kind of like a early, like 60s almost rap thing. And I'm like, yeah, this is, we're doing the revolution right here now on this screen, you know? This is it, guys. You know, it involve it's a revolution because it involves forgetting everything you've been told about yourself and about other. And I didn't invent that. Dogen did, you know, forget the self. This is about forgetting the self. And diving into the, so, you know, it sounds like a contradiction, forget the self by diving into the self, but that's what it is. You know, you have to dive into here and now. What is, and plunge into that unified field of David Lynch. And open to it, you know, that's part of it. Mizumi Roshi had, I think that he called them four precautions or something. Four warnings or something about practice, for the way of practice. And the first one was to avoid intellectual understandings, avoid an intellectual understanding of Zen. And that's a hard one because we always want to try to understand it and, you know, get ahead of ourselves and say, okay, I know what this koan's about. And then people come and they sit down in front of me with the koan and they say their koan and then they say, so this koan is about this and this and this and this. And I'm like, no, ding, 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 it's not. So avoid that, right? Avoid it. It's not easy, but avoid it. And the next one, avoid dwelling on emptiness. So this is, so avoid like hanging on to, you have this glimpse of everything is perfect, true self, unified field, whatever you want to call it. Don't cling to it. He's saying, he doesn't say don't, he says avoid, right? So avoid that, avoid hanging on to that, avoid dwelling there, because then you're off the path then. You're missing the relative world then. You're missing all of the mess that you probably want to hang on to, that emptiness, because you don't want to look at the mess, right? But there's not one without the other. The bodhisattva plunges into the mess, because that's where awakening is. So avoid dwelling in emptiness or in oneness or whatever. Third one, avoid any expectation of enlightenment. And that's a hard one too, because we're like, well, okay, well, what are we doing here? If I'm not supposed to be getting enlightened, what am I doing here? Don't I need to have some kind of objective? It's like David Lynch, don't dive in there to find a solution, Don't dive in there to become awakened, because that's not how it's going to happen. That's going in, again, that's off the path. That's going in the opposite direction. So avoid that expectation. He could have said, avoid any expectation, maybe, but he chose specifically enlightenment. And then, surprisingly, how did he phrase it? Avoid, or no, do not deny the experience of enlightenment. That's it. Don't deny it. Meaning, don't say, well, intrinsically we're all enlightened already, so there's nothing to do. There's nowhere to go. Because everybody's always saying, yeah, we're already enlightened, so then, okay, well, fine. And that was one of Dogen's great questions was, well, if we're all already enlightened, why do we have to do all this? And he took that on, at a very young age as a koan, without calling it a koan, but that was the motor for his practice. What, why, if we're all enlightened, why do we have to do this? So Maizumi Roshi's saying, don't get stuck on that, we're all already enlightened. As the sometimes we phrase it as potential for enlightenment, The Dalai Lama used to say that even Mao had the Buddha nature and the potential to awaken. And we know the horrible things that Mao did to Tibet, right? And those are four really good, precautions to keep us on the way, to keep us. Well, they could be motivations too, to okay, I'm gonna actively not get stuck in an understanding of Zen. I'm going to actively, n when there's some moment of bliss and perfect beauty, I'm not gonna hang on to that. I'm not gonna, expect anything. I'm not gonna expect that moment of beauty and bliss. I'm not going to expect that moment, and if it happens, I'm not going to hang on to it. Because if we hang on to it, then we're expecting it. Again, we're looking out for it. And I'm speaking from experience, because I struggled with that early in my practice. Unfortunately, I had a good teacher. I managed to find a good teacher who like helped me let go of that, who wouldn't let me get stuck there. But then don't deny it either, right? Basically, it's saying just listen. Listen to the sounds of the world. You know, it's hear every sound as a teaching. And don't allow yourself to be caught by despair, sadness, anger. It doesn't mean deny those things either, right? We have to hear those also. That's part of what we hear. It's ourselves. We listen to ourselves. We hear all that stuff that is happening for us. But can we see that maybe before that there was empathy? Or can we notice the, you know, the can we see that our reaction is also, it's good news because it means we haven't cut ourselves off. We haven't shut down. We still have the ability to care and to listen. Can we look at, you know, maybe just the really mundane, ordinary, basic goodness that happens every moment all around us, you know? We see Thomas's son Maru peeking into the screen. Beautiful moment, you know? Can we, you know, all of the network of basic decency and kindness and goodness out there that makes our lives what they are, you know? Can we remember that and not focus only on all the bad, horrible things that happen? Because it's usually louder. Those sounds are louder, very loud. And they're, you know, enhanced and multiplied by our current state of media and internet. And, you know, they're just like multiplied. The sound is multiplied. Major microphones, you know, in our ears. It doesn't mean the other things aren't important, though. You know, I've read that, you know, this completely ridiculous things, you know, like, there was this thing at the Grammy Awards where Kanye West brought his girlfriend and made her undress in front of the, it was a horrible thing, right? And just terrible. If you didn't see it, don't bother. But it's just horrible. And he said this yesterday or the day before, he something. Oh, he said, oh, I'm very proud of it because she is the most Googled person in the universe right now. So if we are like giving importance to what is the most, gets the most likes, is the most Googled, is the loudest, is the most outrageous, the most disruptive, we're missing the point, guys, you know? And I think you all know that. All right, kind of preaching to the converted here, as we say, or you wouldn't be here. So, this is these are just words of, you know, reminder to just listen, also to in words of encouragement maybe, because we're all kind of at a loss. Well, what do we do, you know? Remember that the world just is, that it's interdependent and everything rises and falls. This too will pass. Whatever this is that you feel you're feeling about, it too will pass. And you, if you plunge into the unified field, if you plunge into you, and you open more and more to just this, you will find the way to be, act. So, I guess I'll kind of stop there on those positive seeds for change that are always there. And hear what anyone, if anyone would like to speak, question. I need a glass of water, so I'm gonna stop.
Thank you, Roshi, for this. Just your last words just made me think of the last words of the Buddha. All conditioned things are subject to decay, so strive on with diligence, or in the words of Stephen Batchelor, tread the path with care. So the first part of the sentence almost gives hope. It's like, well, this is not going to last forever, this thing. And just also the second part, just strive on, just tread the path, diligence with care. It's just, let's continue, just yeah, just ongoing, just and yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
In the midst of all that, in the midst of all that, it requires a little bit of trust and faith, and or maybe just not even just doing it, just doing it.
Yep, exactly. Yep, thank you. Yep. And appreciate your life, as my Zumi Roshi used to always say. So that's that. Tread the path with care is kind of that as well, you know. Appreciate this moment because it too will is subject to decay. Let's use the Buddha's words. This moment, it's going. Gone, gone, gone beyond.
Well, if I may say something, thank you very much.
Thanks.
It's always very inspiring to listen to you. And yeah, your words are more than words, I would say. And yeah, for people who are practicing, it's always very important to listen to teachings that are also, as I see, great provocations in a good sense. And while we were talking, what comes to my mind is that personally, I feel that my difficulties, my great difficulties, let's say, is this virtue, one could say, of practicing equanimity, or to have this balance, to be open in such a way that I can do it in, yeah, in this sense of embracing everyone, even, yeah, even people and that obviously out of their lack of wisdom or greed or whatever, like myself, but in a higher degree, perhaps, I have difficulties to do. And I just cannot hammer in my mind, you have to be equanimous. You see, it's always this. I mean, and there are people in my life that I have great difficulties, even very close people. So, Mike, I just wanted to share that perhaps that's one of the, it's not lack of empathy. That has not been my problem. It's really, or perhaps it's, yeah, if I think it better, perhaps it's a lack of empathy for, yeah, for stupidity, basically, I would say. And and lack of the minimum sense of awareness towards life. But this is the only thing I can say, is that I personally feel great difficulties to practice equanimity. That's all.
Yeah. Thank you, Eduard. I think we can all relate to that in our own ways. Maybe sometimes it's not so hard to practice equanimity, but sometimes it's really hard. And the you know, you say you have a hard time telling yourself you have to practice equanimity, but you know that's not how it works. As you well know, it's not by telling ourselves that that it happens. And even you know, saying okay, well now I'm going to practice it, that doesn't work like that either. You know, if we look at Mizumi Roshi's precautions, it's really about staying with you know. Letting go moment to moment, and when we can see the, you know, the absence of self and other, you know, that's those are concepts when I say that. But when we say that, when we concede that, have that experience, then we have this opening to seeing things as they are. And in when we see things just as they are, there is no, you know, this world, you know, we may think of it as being messy, but it's neither good nor bad, or stupid or smart or this or that. It just is what it is. Of course, in relative terms, there is stupidity and there is intelligence. There is awareness and lack of awareness. That's true. You know, there is greed and there's generosity. Someone said that the one of the greatest generosity practices, I wrote this down because I thought it was interesting, is the generosity of attention. Learn to be skillful with where we guide our attention and how. So what do we give our attention to? You know, do we give our attention to all of the things we don't like about that person? Or all of the things that we were judging them as being bad or outrageous or disruptive or something. And that's not to say that they're not that. But if we can let our attention just be without focusing on one thing or the other, or categorizing or judging, then that changes. If we can be generous with our attention, meaning opening our attention. To let it fall evenly, then we have a better chance of behaving with equanimity. Equanimity doesn't mean not being angry or not being upset, but it does change how that anger and upset is expressed and experienced, and what the consequences of it are. So yes, I hear you, and I have great empathy because I know how hard it is sometimes, you know. But the more we practice, it's like, you know, I'd give that example of walking through a field at dawn, and when you get to the other side and you're back on the road, you realize that your shoes and your jeans are wet. You didn't walk across that field to get wet. You weren't even realizing you were getting wet, but you got wet. And that's what happens with our practice. We're not diving in there to find the solutions. But if we do dive in there, if we do it, breath after breath after breath, we find out that we become impermeate, you know, it permeates us. We're not waterproof. That's good news and bad news. We wanted to get our shoes wet, there are lots of easy ways to get your shoes wet. You don't have to walk through a field, you know. at dawn.
Maybe I could also mention about the equanimity of that José Eduardo was talking about. So I'm involved in animal rights, and there's like two sides in animal rights. One is people who say, we got to respect every single little fly, and they have an absolute right. Then there's people who have trouble, being a vegetarian or being something like that. So if there's these two sides, the ideal and the possible. And if there wasn't the possibilities, all the steps, all the baby steps, we couldn't get to the ideal. And if there wasn't an ideal, we wouldn't be inspired to take more baby steps. So I guess that has helped me to see everything as continuous. But of course, there are even people who seem horrible people, but they just set conditions in their life, probably, that they made their minds incapable of having intelligence or compassion or something. So I think that's what I want to say. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Nice to see you back as well. Haven't seen you for a while. Yeah, that's very, very important. I like that image of the little steps and the ideal. And that comes back to what Bernie Glassman said. You do just, okay, you want world peace, but. Or you want to solve the problem with homelessness, or you want to solve unemployment, or you want to solve drug addiction, or you want to solve discrimination or something. Well, if you fantasize about that ideal, you're not going to do anything. So what he did was he just helped the people in his neighborhood. And we do what we can in our place. We choose to. I am basically a vegan. I know their people aren't. There's a butcher on the corner of my street. I do what I can, That's just to come back to the animal rights. So yeah, that's a good point, Don't get caught up in the ideal only with, but you as you point out, well, it's important to remember, okay, well, yes, we want to protect animal rights.
Can I?
Dear Roshi, Miguel, speak. Obrigada. I just loved your Dharma talk also. Thank you so much. But you talk so you touch so many. I can't. It's almost like I can't. My mind, it's through a lot of stuff that you talked. It was I love these Dharma talks when you provide us such a view and clearing spots of the path we are doing here, and really feeling thankful for being here today. You remember something I don't read a lot of time ago about it. I think it was Ajahn Sumedho talking about we meditating in the ideal conditions, and when there is construction noise, we cannot meditate no more, and we have to find a way to do it, or not to choose the noise, or not to choose the ideal situation. You talked much more about why I can do it. And then I thought, and also thank you, José Eduardo, talking about equanimity. This week, I think I told you I'm going to make a surgery. I've known by phone not so long ago, and it grows me a lot of anxiety, which is awful. But I don't know if I'm meditating a lot, and I've been doing some exercise in the morning, and I'm reducing smoking, and I'm feeling a lot of anxiety, and I think, oh, I should be drinking with friends, smoking a lot, just to now help this to go away. But I'm not. And I think somehow I'm managing to accept this gives me a lot of anxiety. And I'm talking about yesterday, my sister called me something, and I said, I have to get out of this conversation. I'm feeling nauseated. And then I put my brain in other stuff because it was too big. And I know it's just a reaction. I think this in this case is a nervous system reaction, that it's too much for the thing that it's in case it's for the problem. And I know it, and I'm somehow opening space to have it and still go on with my life right now. And in a sense, I'm feeling a bit, with all these symptoms, I'm feeling a bit freed. But nothing happened to the anxiety. She's not better. She didn't solve. She didn't get away. I do have some strong reactions to if people talk about it. So I didn't solve it. I just opened some space to be with it, and it gives me some peace, paradoxically. And I think this is what I can share most focusedly in your Dharma talk. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. That's how it works. When we don't push things away and we just allow them to be, then it changes completely. That's why we say, pain is unavoidable, suffering is optional, because the suffering is what we add on to the anxiety. It's what we, when we don't give it space or something. We're out of time. I'm sorry, Miguel, you wanted to say something?
I wanted to say something, but yeah, it's time, so it's okay.
It's not quick.
Yeah, I think, well, I don't know exactly how it to where it goes, but it's like this. In the unified field, as you said, our actions come spontaneously in answer to the circumstances. And when we are in the not aware of that, but are aware of the teachings, the Dharma, we can connect to the Dharma, to the absolute, let's say. From the relative point of view, when we connect to the teachings in right intention, the right understanding, the right action, whatever. At the same time, we in almost every moment, we have to act and make choices.
But there is no, we know from experience that there is no real self in this sense of a conditioned real self. So one thing is, who is choosing when we are not in accordance with the Dharma? When we are in accordance with the Dharma, okay, we are connecting to this not self. Sorry, I'm thinking about what was happening here. But what I guess I want to say is that the wisdom of the unified field is always present, even when we are not aware of it, or we are caught in the
Yep.
delusion of the self.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we have an intention or we have an action that is deluded, but at the same time, it's the same wisdom. We just don't see it. It's just something like this.
That's why we say delusion is enlightenment. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. And sorry for that. I was not explaining myself very clearly.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. We're out of time. Thank you for joining tonight.